Nice little gadget. The size is so wonderful.
It is. It's beautiful. Well, today is May the 13th, I think, 2015. My name is Mario Gard Ewell. I'm president of the Robert E. Gard Foundation, and this is continuing the series of our oral history program. I'm here today with Marjorie Harbaugh Bennett, who goes by the name of Maggie these days, Maggie Bennett. And Maggie is in this series because she was a graduate student getting her master's degree in the 1950s from the Wisconsin Idea Theater. So with that, we'll just launch into the first question, I think, which is an easy one. Tell me about yourself.
Well, I'll tell you why I'm called Maggie.
Okay, please do.
My mother's name was Marjorie.
Ah.
And so they'd say, do you want Big Marjorie or Little Marjorie? I didn't like that. And then I had all these brothers, and everybody called me Sister. And by the time I was getting to be a teenager, I think they're going to think I'm a nun or something. So I was in a play when I was 16, and my name in the play was Maggie. And I thought, that's going to be my name.
That's,
and so ever since then, I've been Maggie.
That's a great way to begin. So tell us, first, to start with when you were born, but then I would love to know something about your parents and your family background.
Sure. Well, I was born in 1932 in Miami, Oklahoma. And I don't remember a whole lot about Oklahoma. We left there when I was about five. I remember the sidewalks being hot, burned your feet if you're barefoot. I remember my diapers falling down when I crossed a bridge where there had been a flood, and seeing forest fires in the sky and playing with little Indian kids and playing cops and robbers with my brothers. But life really started when we moved to Ohio, and we moved to a wonderful old place in Hudson, Ohio, which is a New England type town. And all the trees lined streets, white houses with green shutters. Somebody once painted theirs red and were ostracized. And just had a gorgeous place and big old house with 9 acres. Just kids, five of us, three brothers and a sister, ran wild and had a great childhood. That's the truth.
Well, where were your parents from? Were you a long line of people descended from New England or immigrants?
Oh, no. Oh, goodness. We go way back, and my mother had checked it. And so, you know, I'm French, German, Irish, Danish, and English. So, for example, the English ones are the Prettymans. Ready with a hand. They were with William the Conqueror. The Irish checked into that later on in life. And the Germans came from the Palatinate. And my daughter and I, one of my daughters once, went to the little town where they supposedly originated from, still just a little nothing, Gerstwillerhof, near in the Palatinate near Frankfurt. And there's actually a museum in Frankfurt that documents the people that left there. And so our books and things about our family are in that museum in Frankfurt.
Oh, wonderful.
The Heimat Museum. And let's see, the French, that's interesting. My mother, we go way back to Warvel, that was my grandfather's name. And Brissot de Warvel was one of the aristocrats who came to this country, knew Washington, and Jefferson wrote a book about his travels in this country. Went back when the revolution started, and when they captured the king and queen, he advocated that they not kill them, that they just imprison them. And Robespierre accused him of being a royalist, and he was guillotined. But he's still a hero of France, and I was able to buy Brissot de Warvel's engraved of his face on the bookstalls in Paris years ago.
Oh, goodness. So what were your parents' names?
Well, my father was Dwight Harbaugh, and he grew up in Kansas City. His father died when he was quite young, and he didn't even get to go to college till he was 29. He took care of his mother and his sisters. He sent one sister to drama school. She became an actress in New York City. Another one to home ec school. One sister died young of TB. But he took care of them all, and then he finally told my sister, you take care of mother. So he went to the University of Wisconsin at age 28. And my mother grew up in Chicago. Her father was dean of law school there.
What was her name?
Marjorie Warvel. And George Warvel, her father. And that's the one that the Brissot line, the French. And she grew up in Chicago, and I showed you her book. She wrote a book about her growing up, about the Chicago neighborhood, not only just growing up there, but about all the institutions. It was evidently a very exciting place, with all the wonderful things that started there, innovations. And so she was from Chicago, and she and my father met at the University of Wisconsin. They both got their master's degrees there. Hers in landscape architecture, and his in geology.
Well, it must have been quite something for a woman to have a landscape architecture degree. This would have probably been the 30s or
yes,
maybe.
Early. Yeah, because I was born in 32, and we were already in Miami by then, so 20s probably. And I never realized, you know, and now I'm seeing all her books and things. As kids, you know, she just did her own thing, and she was always tan because she was always working in the yard. But of course, we had help, and we had a black lady who lived with us, and she's the one that made sure you had clean clothes and that kind of thing. If you wanted somebody for dinner, you ask her. You didn't ask my mother.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
I have three brothers and a sister. John, Dan, and Phil are my older brothers, and we had a lot of fun growing up together. And my little sister is 5 years younger, but there's about a 10-year spread with the five of us. And it was really wonderful. I always said I got my education from my parents, really, because the schools weren't that exciting. But my dad used to sit in the living room and in the corner, and he had the National Geographic and Smithsonian, you know, all these wonderful magazines, and he would tell me about those things. And my mother, of course, writing books and things, and every summer he would take me, for example, to visit his sister in New York and leave me there, and I was just a kid. And every morning she would take me to a museum, like the Museum of Natural History, come and have lunch with me, pick me up at night. I spent a week in every major museum, and you can imagine the education that was. My dad took me with him. He was a geologist, and he was president of the Lake Superior Iron Ore Association. So he would go to D.C. a lot, and we would have lunch with congressmen and that sort of thing. And so I just don't remember hardly anything about school. I think I learned everything from my family.
From your family.
Just the exposures. I got to all these wonderful things.
So there must have been a lot of books in your home.
Oh, there was, yes. Wonderful books. We had loads of books. And we had all my grandfather's books. He had first editions of, you know, all the great books. And lots of book learning and reading. Mm-hmm.
So do you remember anything about school? You said most of your learning came from...
Well, I remember I was very shy. And I was young. I started first grade when I was 5. And I always have been a little squirt. And I just remember, even when I was trying to be a femme fatale as a teenager, I didn't even ask. They would give me child's tickets to the movies. I don't think it was well into my 20s before I could get an adult ticket for something. So I wasn't exactly but what I enjoyed doing was our big place. You know, we had a big barn, and I had a pony and then eventually a horse, and I rode a lot, and we were right next to the woods. So we spent a lot of time, and then with my dad, we'd go out and look for Indian. He had these books about archaeology and where the Indian places were, and we'd look for artifacts. And then he would tell you about how this used to be desert, or this was covered with ice. And like I say, just wonderful education from my parents.
So they're
not intentional, just by being around them.
Sounded like it was a family that really valued education. Was it assumed from the get-go that you'd be going to college?
I suppose. I don't remember ever talking about it much. When I was, my dad was the head of in our little town, which was only like, 1,000, 1,200 people, the library. He was the head of the group that brought in speakers, and then there was no hotel or anything. They would stay with us, and they'd always give us a book about Egypt or something. And so I got really intrigued with all these talks and things at the library and these people that would come. And I told my dad, and besides, it was just, you know, the war years, and I said, you know, people are all the same. I think we should all get to know each other. I'd like to go and see these places. He said, study hard in school, get good grades, learn a foreign language, and maybe you can do that. You know, he said, there are lots of programs that kids can do that. So I was very young when I decided, okay, that's what I'm going to do. And I had some help from upstairs. I won a car when I was 14. That didn't do any harm. So I had even some money of my own. But when I was 16, I don't know how it came about, but I talked Kent State University, which was just about 5 to 7 miles away, in letting me come and take French for the summer. And my professor was from Russia. And I thought, boy, college is really neat because we have class all morning. Then we would go and have lunch together and then sit out under the trees all afternoon and talk about the meaning of life and philosophy. And I said, I don't want to go back to high school. I'm going to stay. And so, you know, like I say, my parents, they just let you do what you like. So I stayed on at Kent. They let me stay. And I needed one more high school course. And they had a teacher's training play or something. I took my last English class there. And so, and that's where I got in the play. I got a lead in the play and got the name Maggie because that was the Wanhope building. So I went out for, and was in a children's theater group and that kind of stuff. So I was perfectly happy to stay there. But my brother had been at Denison University in Granville with the V-12, one of my oldest brothers, John. And she thought Granville looked like a good spot for me. So she encouraged me to transfer to Granville, to Denison. So that's where I went. And I, with those advanced credits, it just took me 3 years to finish there. And Denison at that time was part of the Great Books Movement. So it was a wonderful education because you got the history of art, the history of music, the history of, and I didn't, I asked my father, what should I major in? And he said, oh, it doesn't matter. Just take whatever's interesting. You'll just get married and have a family. You don't need to worry about that. Well, of course, he lied to me. I didn't realize that. But then one day they said, well, you know, if you took one more philosophy course, you'd have a philosophy major. I said, okay. So that's how I became a philosophy major. So I graduated a year early. Well, I went in with the class of 53, but I graduated in 52. And I was second in my class, and Phi Beta Kappa and all that. And so it was pretty wonderful. And plus, I had this, you know, the thing to go to Europe, and I applied for a scholarship, and I got one to go to the Sorbonne. But my father died just before my birthday, just before my 20th birthday. I was just 19 when he died. And he said, well, I kept a thing that he told me. Where is it? Here, somewhere. Oh, anyhow.
You want me to turn off the recorder?
No, that you need to turn it off. I don't, here it is. So he died on March 19th, and my birthday was March 26th, and I was feeling very sad, and I was rumbling my desk, and I found this letter written on my birthday a week, the year before. And so this has been my guidelines for my life from my dad. And he said, there are things for you to do in the world, but it's more important that you be all that God can expect of you. Nobility of character is the real key to all that is worthwhile. And it lends to what you do something that makes all the difference. Someone said there's only a little difference between people. That little difference makes all the difference. We live in a troubled world. But I'm sure there's help for all who ask for it. So keep the channel clear and your aims high. So those words from my father have been my guideline from him. And then I delayed going to the Sorbonne because I wanted to help my mother because, you know, my father had just died and she was selling the place and all that. And so I didn't go until the second semester, and then I was there second semester and the summer. But that was just, oh, I just loved France. And hang out at the folk song places in Madison. By then, at Denison, I had gotten an auto harp. I had a friend who played the auto harp, so I took my auto harp to France with me. And we would sit on the trains, and I'd get out the auto harp, and we'd all sing on the trains. And I learned tons of French songs. I know lots of, and I made very close French friends, still friends. One of my daughters went and lived with them in high school for a year, and learned to cook. And they've come here, and we've been there, and just been lifelong, almost like family. My French friends that I made there, Lucette Angers.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, you got your auto harp when you were in college. Did you ever think that it would be the auto harp that would lead you to your career?
No, I didn't. I just knew that I liked it. And like I say, I took it to France with me, and my French friends liked it. And, you know, and then there was this club where they sang folk songs, French and American folk songs. And so I hang out there, and I learned a ton of my repertoire there. But then just, you know, I just, my French friends, we'd play and sing with the auto harp, and I just been playing it ever since.
So did you start thinking much about American folk songs at that point?
Well, yes, because the folk song club, I forget the name of it, there was an American folk singer and a French folk singer, so they'd sing American and French. And I think I told you that when I was a toddler, I had lockjaw. And I'm just a miracle that I'm here at all. You know, I wasn't supposed to survive. And the only sense that was operative for months was hearing. I still have very acute hearing, and I remember what I hear. So I remember the words. And like when I was in growing up, I sang in the church choir. I remember the words to all those hymns still. Anything that had a tune to it and words to it, I remember. So I don't know my kids' social security numbers and phone numbers, but I know every song just about that I've ever heard, you know.
Well, that's wonderful. So when you were at Denison then, and then the Sorbonne, something led you to graduate study. What was that?
When I, you know, it was time to come back, and I realized, you know, my father had lied to me that, you know, I wouldn't need to worry about what I was going to be. And I thought, well, maybe I'd better go back to school and get an education degree or something, do something. And, of course, my parents, of course, loved Wisconsin, having both gone there. My mother always said she'd like to live and die in Madison. My brother was there, my oldest brother, getting his PhD in geology. So I had family there. So I applied to Wisconsin, and to my great delight, got a position as a graduate counselor living in I lived in Elizabeth Water Hall. So that gave me room and board and tuition. So free, you know, to go to school. And I ate my meals there. The only thing was on Sunday nights, the dining room was closed. So I took my auto harp. I showed you a picture of it. I went to the St. Nicholas Cafe and sang folk songs. For my dinner, I got $3 and my dinner, and that paid for my shampoo and stuff, so everything was taken care of. And then, good fortune on top of good fortune, I got hired as an assistant to help get started our show there in Madison.
Well, that is so interesting. Did you seek it out, or did you see
your
posting?
Well, your dad was... I think I was regional writing. Well, that would have been a course he taught. I think he was one of my first teachers. He and Jonathan Kirvin. And they were so inspiring, you know, about folklore and everything. And I think they approached me, would I help them, you know, and hired me as an assistant. And so that's when we made all the trial kinescopes to try to find a format, because we didn't know what to do. And Ed Kamark was the director. He didn't. Nobody knew anything about television. We didn't know whether to look at each other or to look at the camera. And we tried a lot of different formats, actually, in the experimental period.
Well, let me just throw in, I think, so Wisconsin is famous for its notion of outreach and education. And
right.
WHA Radio
yes.
reached all over the state.
That's right.
So you were an assistant at the Wisconsin Idea Theater when they were starting to do the same experimentation with television.
Decided,
is that right?
They had just gotten grants, money to start television, and nobody knew anything about it. And so we were just, you know, in the dark. But we tried, I think we had like 13 experimental kinescopes, and we tried different formats before we finally hit on the last one, which was just Wisconsin is my doorstep, sitting on the front steps reminiscing. But we tried, you know, some more elaborate things with little skits and things and in costumes, and your dad dressed up as Lincoln and that sort of thing. And I remember that my comment on that one was, well, the only problem was the beard. You know, when he was himself and when he was supposed to be Lincoln, it was a little confusing.
Sure it was. Well, you know, I'm going to bet that a lot of people listening to this recording, especially people listening in the future, aren't even going to be familiar with the word kinescopes. Maybe you could just start us through the whole basics, starting with vocabulary.
Well, kinescope was just, you know, a way of recording it, like we're calling this a tape recording. It's not really a tape recording anymore, but that's the... And kinescope was just the way that things were recorded on film. And actually, I had some of them, and I gave them to a guy here from my future. And unfortunately, the guy died, and I never got them back. But they were enormous. I mean, they were huge box, and they were real wide, you know, taped and everything. But that's how we recorded things. And so we made the kinescopes, and we started out with the idea that because we knew you had to see something, and so to hear and see, because coming from radio background. So that's where they got the idea of having the artist who would sketch things, and then I was to add the element of song, plus to help in the interview, the banter back and forth between the host, which are your dad, of course, the yarn spinner. And so and as I say, we tried many, many formats, and we finally, and I think it was partially just for simplicity, settled on having this doorstep, the idea of sitting on the front steps and talking about various things in Wisconsin lore and history and traditions.
So give us a little bit of context when you say what. We talked about WHA-TV furthering the idea of the mm-hmm. Wisconsin idea to reach all the people of the state, but as you remember it, what were Gard and his staff in the Wisconsin Idea Theater? What
were
they trying to do?
They were doing all kinds of things. It wasn't just this television. Mm-hmm. Of course, they had the radio. And then one thing, we had a group called the Drama Quartet, four of us. I can't remember. I've got the names written down. I think I gave them to you. I don't remember. But anyway, four of us, we went out and did, you know, dramatizations as a quartet. At that time, there was actually a one that was very popular nationally, I think, and we kind of stole the model from them. But we did different shows. I remember I was in Glass Menagerie and those sort of things.
So you produced plays all over the state?
Well, as a Reader's Theater.
Oh, Reader's
Theater. Reader's Theater, a drama quartet with the four of us.
Uh-huh.
We did that. We traveled with that. And, of course, I was in the University Theater as well. I had a big lead in the Cherry Orchard. So I would have many rehearsals. I'd have the TV rehearsal, the drama quartet rehearsal, you know, the play at the UW, and, we just trying everything. But the whole idea was to, and then when I finished, the Extension Division hired me to go and do a four-month tour of visiting all these four states, mostly in Wisconsin. But I went to, for 4 months, this was after I got back from Europe. I went to Europe after I got my degree. I finished my master's because I just wanted to do some research on my own. And I took voice and harp and developed my wonderful, wonderful year in Europe. But when I came back, I did this four-state tour. And I did every kind of media you can imagine, from little country schools to big city places, you know. And what a wonderful training ground. And I drove myself between the different places. I was brave, and I somehow found where I was going. And I remember you going to a school, and if it was a Catholic school, somebody would help you carry your harp. And if it was public school, you're on your own. And so I did that for 4 months, and that really honed your ability and your confidence, for that matter.
I'm sure. Yeah. So were you doing one-woman shows, or were you singing?
Just me.
Or,
oh, yeah.
And it was all singing and talking about the music?
Oh, yeah, it was singing and stories and just talking about different cultures. Huh. And I've got some pictures in there. I guess at that time, I've seen there's one, like, for example, I'm wearing an Arab outfit. And I did learn, when that year that I went abroad, I learned songs from Greece, and I had costume pieces from, you know, La French. I had a high French lace cap that they wore in Brittany. And so I would change the hat and the costume piece to fit the culture of the song I wrote.
And this was on behalf of UW Extension?
Extension Division. Mm-hmm. Hmm. It was a tour that's sponsored by the Extension Division.
Huh, so interesting.
Yeah.
I would love it if you would go back to the early days of TV, because, of course, here in 2015, TV is very slick. There's all sorts of animation, all sorts of fancy effects.
None of that.
Tell us about live. Yeah.
Everything was live.
So tell us what a show might have been.
Well, a show, for example, let's just say the one that we finally did our opening with, the Lumber Show.
Okay.
And so we wanted, we got artifacts, you know. We also got historic photos. We had Bill Schaefer drawing pictures, so we talked about lumbering, and then he would draw pictures. And so that we felt that.
So you had a visual artist actually sketching.
Yeah, we had a visual artist sketching during the show. Then I would sing an appropriate song, or, you know, Once More Lumbering Go, or your dad would cue me and say, "Have you got a song about, you know, this or that?" And so we had the dimension of song and visual and actual artifacts and photographs.
So Mr. Schaefer, when he was drawing, what would he be doing? For example, if you were singing, would he be illustrating your song?
Well, sometimes. But this, eventually, when we finally went live, we gave up having him because it was very difficult for him to talk and draw at the same time. And the coordination of the drawing with the discussion and, you know, was difficult. And so Ed Kmark decided that we should give up that just in the interest of simplicity. But it did add a lot when we did have it. And we would, you know, your dad would be telling a story, and then he would be sketching it, and then he'd say, "Let me see what you got there, Bill." And then the camera would pan in on the, of course, and I learned all the technology, you know. So by the time I went on my own career, then I knew all the terms and everything. But the thing that was so different back then is everything is live. And so, for example, timing. I mean, you could run out of things to say, or you could have all of a sudden you know, to come out right and have the show end. Look, that was a real knack.
So how long would be a typical show? 15
well,
minutes?
Well, we
half
started
hour?
Out half an hour, and then we decided to go to a 15-minute format.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
And why did you decide to shorten it?
I guess just... would be like, for example, I remember the one on disasters, and we had the Lady Elgin, and then some forest fires and that kind of thing. And Ed and your dad just thought it'd be better to have them as separate shows and just focus, for example, because the Lady Elgin was so interesting and such a big story that it kind of got overwhelmed, you know, all the other natural disasters and catastrophes and things.
So the Lady Elgin was a steamboat, steamboat sinking on Lake Michigan, wasn't it?
And that became a separate program. Mm-hmm. And so they just decided to focus more sharply on a smaller area. And but as I say, we learned the hard way. Sometimes we had too much material. I don't think we never didn't have enough. We could always sit there and shoot the breeze, your dad. You know, he didn't lack in that department.
He was a storyteller.
Yeah, yeah. So,
So how many cameras did you have, and how did the? Do you remember
goodness.
How the camera?
I don't
all
remember.
Worked?
I just remember, in seeing the kinescopes afterward. I mean, in fact, my kids kid me because one of the ones what I showed them. And it's come to the end of the show, and I'm in the middle of a song, and your dad says, "That'll be enough, Marge." And I keep on singing. that'll be enough, Marge. That'll be enough. And so to this day, they still say to me, that'll be enough, Marge. But just trying to time, you know, the closing. Now, what was your question? I forgot.
Oh, just how the camera work
worked. Oh, well, you know, they were learning too. So it was just, and actually they did some evaluation things and have people, you know, press when the most interesting things were. And it was usually when we were showing an artifact or the historic photos or sometimes a song if I was lucky. But they liked a little, people seemed to like a little action, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Of eat movement.
Uh-huh.
And like when the Indian came into the dance, that was a popular one.
Uh-huh. So this would have been, what, 1953-ish?
In the 50s, yeah.
Early 50s, about?
What year were we doing these? Oh, good heavens. Yeah. Well.
I think your dissertation
54.
Was... 54. 50, okay.
Yeah, 54.
So then you wrote your dissertation about your
My
whole television experience.
My dissertation was just telling you was the scripts, mm-hmm. as well as the just what worked and what didn't work, and as we learned as we went through, step by step, you know, what seemed to work for us and what didn't. And
so how did you said you had 13 or 14 of the kinescope possibilities and settled on Wisconsin as my doorstep,
yeah.
for the kind of theme. What was it that you were looking for? What caused you to reject certain ones?
Well, just because, first place, ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we would be overly ambitious sometimes in the amount of material that we wanted to cover. And we couldn't, you know, we just learned that you got to do what you can do right and well in a short period rather than trying to be cover too much.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we ever ran out of things to say. That wasn't a problem for talkers like us, but...
And you always had a song for
yeah.
any occasion,
and I
suppose.
Had song, yeah. And you know, some. I remember once he ran short and he asked me, he said, well, sing a song from next week's show, you know, to fill. But there was always a way to fill, so
uh-huh.
that wasn't a problem. But when I've seen some of those early, again, there would be a microphone hanging down, or occasionally the shot would be too wide and would get some of the backdrop, you know, that wasn't supposed to be in the picture. It was crude. It was crude in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But we learned, and like I said, Kmart and all these guys, they learned.
Well, so as I understand it, the whole idea of the Wisconsin Idea Theater was to help people from Wisconsin know more about their own culture.
Exactly.
And maybe try their hand at writing some shows of their own, just like
yeah.
Gard would take the Lady Elgin story, for example,
right.
and then turn it into a radio play or a
right.
script for a
right.
setting for a TV
right.
show. Is that what the Wisconsin Idea Theater was?
I don't recall that we got solicitations mm-hmm. of scripts. It was more just sharing the culture and hopefully alerting people to the background of these places where they lived and the traditions that were, and we talked about, you know, maybe someday doing the ethnic traditions of the very, we never got to that, but if it had gone on longer, we probably would have, you know, done that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
And got into the local, you know, like the Germans and the mm-hmm. Norwegians and that kind of thing. But we didn't do that, no.
But it could have happened
in a couple more years. It could have happened,
uh-huh.
and those, you know, thinking ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I mean, like when I went out, you know, and did my thing, then I talked about, you know, various ethnic groups and that
mm-hmm.
sort of thing.
Hmm. So we've asked everybody in this series to recollect Gard. Do you remember anything about your first meeting with him?
I don't remember the first one. I'm sure it was just as a professor
uh-huh.
in a class, you know. But obviously, we hit it off, or he wouldn't have asked me to help out with this.
What kind of a guy was he?
Oh, goodness.
Do you remember things about his style or the way he worked
well,
with people?
I thought the doorstep was a great idea because it was like just sitting on in a rocking chair on the front porch talking to somebody and reminiscing. And so, very low-key and, you know... I don't ever remember feeling nervous or anything. I mean, you were totally at ease, and anybody that was having to do with the show, I think, felt at ease because he just put you at ease and we just, let's just talk like friends, you know. And I don't remember being in particularly in awe of him because he was a professor or anything like that. I don't think he ever, you know, he just treated you like a nice friend, human mm-hmm. being, yeah.
And he was also, they were also doing, like you mentioned, the regional rural writing program.
Yes, uh-huh.
Which was...
And I think that some of these scripts probably came out of, you know, his radio series. In fact, I was looking at his Wisconsin Doorstep, you know, and the Hodak, and those stories are in his earlier books and things. So he had a wealth of material, you know, to call on. So we didn't need to search for material to do. We could, you know, just turn some of those radio and, you know, written things into television. And that was what we were trying to do, is how to make it be alive and visually interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And something that people would, you know, sit in their living room and turn on. And,
uh-huh. And I suppose part of the objective might be, if I was sitting in my living room listening to you, I might get curious about the stories in my own backyard. Would that be part of it?
Yeah, we hope so.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know, they're very much like the lady who was the start of the hospital and stuff. I mean, they were all local community stories, you know. And I'm sure if you were from that, and I didn't know of her before, but if I had been from that community, I probably would have known her, the one that started the Veterans Hospital.
Oh, Mrs. Cordelia Harvey.
Yeah, right. And I wouldn't have known of her, but if I had been from that area, I probably would have known of her.
Mm-hmm.
But it just spreading, sharing with everybody the traditions of the various pockets and things.
As I remember it, when I was a very little girl, the Wisconsin Idea Theater was in Camp Randall Stadium. Were you there during that time?
I don't remember
that. Or do you remember where the offices were?
No, I don't.
This seems to have been a program that migrated all over campus.
I don't know where the studio mm-hmm. was. The studio wasn't anything fancy. I mm-hmm. mean, it was just jerry-rigged.
Uh-huh. I'm sure it was.
And like I say, the technicians, they didn't know. Nobody knew anything,
mm-hmm.
but we learned.
Well, let's see, there was
by doing.
Old Radio Hall that was on Bascom Hill, sort of over to one side, off Observatory Drive. Is that where you might have been?
Yeah, I just don't remember the actual setting.
Yeah.
I remember, of course, Bascom and the hill and all that. But I don't recall where we actually went physically
mm-hmm.
to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it might not have always been the same place, for that matter.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, how interesting. So you got your degree in, what, 2 or 3 years?
Oh, no, I got it in that 1 year.
Oh, did you really?
A year and a summer.
Goodness, mm-hmm. So you did all of your television shows, help with
well,
the
see,
format?
Well, see, what was the nice part about it is the television show record became my thesis, so uh-huh. I didn't have to do, you know, something in addition to that. And then I took the courses, of course, and I loved your dad's courses and Jonathan Kirvin's courses. And I don't know, went fast. And so when I finished, that's when they hired me. They wanted me to go right out then and do the, you know, the four-state tour. And I said, well, when I was at the Sorbonne, it was, you know, they didn't heat those lecture halls and things, and I was freezing. I saw these kids with a tan. I said, where have you been? And they had been skiing in Austria. And they said, you want to go with us? We're going. So I went, and I remember I skied in jeans and a cashmere sweater. And from the very beginning, they took us up to the top of the mountains. I just fell in love with Austria because here's all these, I thought it was an operetta or something, all these people in the costumes and the music, and I just said, I want to go back there and explore. And I had money, I had saved my money, because they had paid me, plus I had, you know, I told you, won that car early on, so I had, even though so I went for a year.
To Europe. Mm-hmm.
And I headquartered in Innsbruck, Austria. I took voice lessons. I went to Ireland and got a harp. Brought the harp back, started learning to play the harp, took voice. I tried to learn to play the zither. I never was very good at it, but going to the Hermann Amariller Zitterschule, and every time I'd go, he'd kiss my hand. I remember that. And then my mother came over and took me on a cruise, a 2-month cruise of North Africa and the Middle East and Greece. And so, I mean, what an education, you know.
Oh, my goodness, yes. And then you came back?
So I came back. I flew right to go do the tour. And they must have got me a car. I don't know what I had. Forgot me. I had a car. And I drove myself, and it was all laid out.
So they set up the tour
Everything
for you.
Everything was all set. And it was Wisconsin Idea Theater. And like I say, and I don't remember, I remember once going to, like, I've got a bunch of letters from, you know, people sent me that they enjoyed it. One of them was, like, for example, to go to the nuns at Cincinnati Academy. And they let me spend the weekend there. Well, most of the places, you know, you did 45 minutes an hour. I mean, they would have kept me all night, those nuns, you know, singing and performing. But it was just, and I've never, thanks to my family, I've never known fear. I haven't ever been afraid. And so, you know, to go to Europe and do these things by myself, I remember my boyfriend who, then I had known in college, he was in the Air Force, and he started flying his plane when I'd be in some Chicago or someplace and come see me. And he got me a gun. He said, you should have it. And so I had a gun in the glove compartment. And when you went to these little towns, you just stay wherever. I stayed in this old boarding house or whatever it was. And late at night, somebody knocks on my door and said, I had something for you. That kind of scared me. So I went and got the gun, and I pulled the dresser over in front of the door between the connecting rooms, and I sat there all night in bed. But I never had to use it. But anyhow, but he was worried about me. But anyhow, it was quite an adventure doing those tours.
Well, that is so interesting. Actually, I had not known that the Wisconsin Idea Theater put people like you on the road to do such...
Right.
So
it was very extensive.
Some community presentations, school presentations,
schools,
a little of everything.
Communities, everything, you name it. Clubs, schools, churches. And I did 12 a week. I mean, that's a lot.
12 a week?
Yeah.
Goodness.
And sometimes 3 a day, you know. And I had to drive myself between places. I don't know. Like I say, I just never knew any better. But I was never taught to be afraid or not to speak to strangers. Uh-huh. And, of course, I went to Europe by myself, all those things.
So it was, let's see, you said 4 states. So Wisconsin, Iowa?
Well, yeah, and a little bit. I mean, it was mostly in Wisconsin, but a little, just the neighboring, you know, a little bit of Michigan. And
Iowa, Illinois, and Michigan, probably?
Yeah. A little bit of those neighboring states, but mostly... Anybody says I'm from a little town, Wisconsin, I said I've been there. Because I have, you know. I went to every little burg. But that really gave you the confidence in the future. I mean, you couldn't faze me with nothing, you know.
So then did you have a little script that you were supposed to say about extension? Or were you supposed
I don't remember. I don't remember. I just remember that... the theme was, you know, cultures of the world, and I just don't remember that. I think I probably varied a little bit about where I was, and by the age group, you know, and for you know, country school a little bit different than doing a big city.
So cultures of the world. I had not known that the Wisconsin Idea Theater.
Well, that
was doing that. Was that because of you?
Think it's because I had just come back from, you know, visiting all those places. Mm-hmm. I had all these costume pieces. And so I would change the hat as fit the costume, you know, or like sunbonnet if it's American or something.
It sounds like it was kind of built around you. You had these interests.
Yeah, it was just kind of... what was it called? I have no idea what they called it. It would just be... I just think... Well, I always called my shows Folk Song Heritages, you know, so just different heritages of different peoples and ethnic and occupational groups.
That's wonderful. I mean, that they should just say, you have this interest, you have this knowledge, you have this skill, we'll put you on the road doing what
and
you do.
And they wanted me to go right from grad school, you know, right there. But I talked to them and said... I signed a contract, I'll come back in here, and I came back and I went right to doing that.
Hmm. So interesting.
Yeah.
Well, before, maybe we can take a little pause in a minute, but before
sure.
we do that, is there anything else you remember about your Wisconsin years, your Madison years, before we leave Madison? Or the university,
wow.
any other professors
oh,
that particularly?
Goodness. Well, those ones I remember best was Jonathan Kirvin, because I remember Ed Kmart and Jonathan Kirvin. And just because I guess the shared interest in folklore so much, and wonderful classes. And actually, this wasn't Wisconsin, but I'd had a teacher, what was his name, Dennison, who was into folklore too. Just one class, but just to just be totally immersed in all that, you know. And then, of course, the drama part too. I did take play direction, and you know, later when I taught drama, I did take actually the drama classes required to get a degree in master's in drama.
So did you what did you actually get your master's in? Was it drama?
Yeah, drama.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Huh.
And speech and drama, I guess it was called, and so. I did take play direction and that kind of thing, and did use those skills later on when I taught public school.
Were you living at Liz Waters the whole time?
Liz Waters the whole time, uh-huh. which was just wonderful, you know, because it was right there. You could look at the lake, and I just think how fortunate I was, you know, because I was actually earning money. Most people, it's going to school, it's struggling here. Very few people that actually earn money, and, you know, because like I say, my father died, I was just barely 20,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't get any help from home after that, and I got all the rest of my education, travels, everything, just been guardian angel.
So I would imagine when you were in Madison, most of the students were just students, they weren't also working, then if you said it was...
Well, I'm just trying to remember, you know, I was so involved in those different things, like the drama quartet and being in the play. Of course, uh-huh. when you're in a play, that's you're totally involved.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember it was a very happy time, and I just enjoyed all of it, you know, and then even singing in the cafe,
uh-huh.
and that was fun,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, just every day was a pleasure.
So do you watch television now with a critical eye as a result of all that early work?
No, because television today is so canned, you know. And I think, well, my shows later on, I did have a career in television, but we're sort of the end of live television. It's a wholly different ballgame when you're I can just remember, you know, I'd always have to have padding material, you know, in case I ran out of things to say, stuff that I could launch into, because that you the camera was on you and you better mm-hmm. have something to say. They don't have any of that today. Everything is canned.
Mm-hmm.
You know? They don't. There's, I guess, the talk shows are alive and uh-huh. the dance and that kind of stuff, but it's not the same. What's to say? I enjoyed it I don't think I would like it as much now. Maybe I would, but if you had live interplay with people, I would like it.
Mm-hmm.
But that was what the fun part was. You know?
I expect that's true. Well, why don't we take just a few minute
okay.
break and a stretch, and then we'll talk about the rest of your career after Wisconsin. So we're back with Maggie Bennett, and I'm Mary O'Gard. Robert Gard was my dad, and Maggie was also, when we knew her as Marjorie, was my babysitter when I was a little girl, and she used to sing us and play us some of the songs that she's discussed earlier in this segment.
Right.
So I asked if she'd sing or play something, and
here
I'm
I
looking
am.
At that very auto harp that you
and
had.
And this auto harp is amazing. You know, I mean... Well, my harp, for example, is 100 years old, my Irish harp. I mean, and this auto harp has been all over the world, and what I love about the auto harp is it's so durable, because I've had kids knock over my wooden harp and break it, you know. But this, they can't hurt it. So when I was volunteering overseas and stuff, I mean, I remember the little kids that had lost limbs and minds, they'd scoot up on their bottoms and get up close and try to play it, you know. And wonderful memories. But this one, I apologize that I'm a little hoarse, spring allergies, But this is my favorite song because it was one my dad always sang to me. And then when later years, I had a FM radio show for kids called the Rummy Dummy Nine, and you took a magic train ride. On the rummy line, on the dummy line, rain or shine, you pay your fine. Rain or shine, you pay your fine. Ride, ride, ride on the rummy dummy line. I got a gal down in Mobile, got a face like a lemon peel. She's got a wart on the end of her chin. She calls it a dimple turns in. On the rummy line, on the dummy line, rain or shine, you pay your fine. Rain or shine, you pay your fine. Ride, ride, ride on the rummy dummy line. Once was a doctor, his name was Black. Fell in a well and he broke his back. Served him right, he should have known. Enough to make it sick and leave the well alone. On the rummy line, on the dummy line, rain or shine, you pay your fine. Rain or shine, you pay your fine. Ride, ride, ride on the rummy dummy line. Way down south on Cedar Street, fellers all grow to be 6 feet. They go to bed, it ain't no use, cause their feet stick out for the chickens to roost. On the rummy line, on the dummy line, rain or shine, pay your fine. Rain or shine, pay your fine. Ride, ride, ride on the rummy dummy line. I bought me a suit of combination underwear to keep out the cold and the grizzly winter air. I wore it 6 months, I couldn't get it off because I lost the combination. On the rummy line, on the dummy line, rain or shine, pay your fine. Oh, rain or shine, pay your fine. Ride, ride, ride on the rummy dummy line. There once was a man, his name was Zeke. Wore false teeth, he was quite a freak. He put him on a chair instead of on a shelf, and when he sat down, why, he bit himself. On the rummy line, on the dummy line, rain or shine, you pay your fine. Rain or shine, pay your fine. When you ride, ride, ride on the rummy dummy line.
Woo, that's wonderful. I wonder if you'd do one more. This was, I remember your singing, She'll Be Coming Around the Mountain.
Oh, goodness. Well, that's pretty easy to do.
Yeah, but it's stuck in my memory for 60 years.
Hey, you got to sing with me then.
Okay, then.
Come around mountain when she comes. She'll be coming around the mountain when she comes. When she comes. She'll be coming around the mountain. She'll be coming around the mountain. Coming around the mountain. Six wide comes. She'll be driving six white horses when she comes.
Gee-haw.
She'll be driving six white horses when she comes.
Gee-haw.
She'll be driving six white horses. She'll be driving six white horses. Driving six white horses when she comes. We will all go out to meet her when she comes.
Hi, babe.
We'll all go out to meet her when she comes.
Hi, babe.
Oh, we'll all go out to meet her, and we'll all go out to meet her, all go out to meet her when she comes. She'll be wearing pink pajamas when she comes. She'll be wearing pink pajamas when she comes. She'll be wearing pink pajamas, wearing pink pajamas, wearing pink pajamas when she comes.
Ooh, woo!
Oh, she'll have to sleep with Grandma when she comes. Have to sleep with Grandma when she comes. Oh, she'll have to sleep with Grandma. Have to sleep with Grandma. Have to sleep with Grandma when she comes. And we'll kill the old red rooster when she comes.
Chop, chop.
We will kill the old red rooster when she comes.
Chop, chop.
We will kill the old red rooster. We will kill the old red rooster. Kill the old red rooster when she comes. And we'll all have chicken and dumplings when she comes.
Mm-mm.
And we'll all have chicken and dumplings when she comes.
Yum, yum.
Oh, we'll all have chicken and dumplings. We'll all have chicken and dumplings.
Well, I have chicken and dumplings when she comes.
Wonderful. Makes me feel like I'm 5 years old again. So we're back with Maggie Bennett, and she has graduated from the university with her thesis behind her. She's taken gone to Europe. She has come back. Done a concert tour. And what next?
Well, on this concert tour, I had this boyfriend when I was a dentist, and he was real good looking, and all the girls were chasing him, but I didn't chase him. I'd rather go to the library. But he liked to chase me. And so when I was on the concert tour, he was in the Air Force at that time, and I'd be in Chicago or some big city, and he'd fly his airplane, come see me, you know. And so that was quite romantic courting. And so I got engaged, and then I went back home, and my sister was engaged, and she was getting married in the end of August, and it was early. So I went home, and I thought, well, I'll help my mom. She's going to be moving. So while I was there, one of our neighbor's sons was working at a TV station in Cleveland, Ohio, at KYW, Westinghouse Station. And he said, why don't you come up and sing your songs on Tom Haley's show someday? So I went there, and when the show was over, Tom Haley said, you know, we have a big problem here because we're opposite Miss Frances, and we need something to draw people in with children so they can watch, the mothers can watch our show. Would you do a children's segment for us? So I said, sure. So that's what I did. And I did that until I got married. And it was a wonderful experience. Of course, it was live television. And what I had was, I don't know where I got the idea, but I always loved the Wizard of Oz, the Tin Man. And so I had them make me a Tin Man. And we called him Mr. Rivets. And I would just get anybody who was available to get in the Tin Man costume and be the Tin Man. And then Mr. Rivets had to learn about life. And so for my little segment, each time I would teach Mr. Rivets something, you know, whatever it was, Cinco de Mayo, then we'd do Cinco de Mayo stuff or whatever it was. And no rehearsal. I mean, the guy just had to do what I told him. But it was lots of fun, and it turned out to be a big success, and I've got pictures of fan mail with pictures of Mr. Rivets. And we even went out and did some public things, and the poor guy inside, you know, kids would come up and beat on the tin, and he said it was pretty miserable. But I did that right up until the time I got married, and I have a wonderful letter for. They said, you know, if you're ever near a Westinghouse station, we'll always have a job for you. And if I hadn't gotten married and stayed there, I'd probably have a news show or, you know, had a career in television. And even when I came back in the summers, because we left after I got married, went to the University of Colorado, they would give me a segment on the Tom Haley show in the summertime. So I did that. And so that was my commercial television excursion. And, of course, all that wonderful training, I knew all about television. And so that was a lot of fun, and it was a great success. And of course, I got paid for that, too. So then we had a big double wedding in my mother's garden, and we got married on the tennis court, and I remember she spent all summer, we had a lot of rain that summer, replanting all the flowers to be the altar and all that, but anyhow, we had the double wedding, and then with my husband, we went to Colorado, where he enrolled. He had been in pre-med, which really his heart wasn't in it at Denison, but here now he wanted to be a test pilot, and he needed an engineering degree, so he enrolled in the School of Engineering, and I just walked up one day to the speech and drama department and just told him I had this nice background from Wisconsin and start tomorrow. So I taught part-time for the 4 years I was at the university there.
Were you teaching in television or broadcasting?
No, well, I taught all kinds of things. I did some television, voice and diction, you know, whatever they needed, oral interpretive literature, many different courses, whatever they asked me to do. And so I taught there part-time the whole time that we were in Boulder. and we lived in the Mary Student Housing. And then my cousin was married to the guy who ran the educational television station there. He invited me to do series, and so the years I was there, I did folk song heritage television shows for KCTS. Oh no, let's see, KRMA it was called, KRMA. And I also, it was a wonderful time, because those were, you know, the folk years. And that was the 60s. So I started singing in the pubs with this little gal. She was 19, her name was Judy Collins. And Judy and I sang in pubs in Boulder and in Denver. And one time, Glenn Yarbrough asked us to come over to Aspen and sing, and Judy went, but my husband said, I don't think you should go traipsing off with her to Aspen. So I didn't go, unfortunately. I should have. But we sang in the pubs. We, you know, were very active in the folk song. And then when I had my show, I had people like Judy and John Greenway and all the local folk people who were in the folk thing there. Lingo the Drifter was a weirdo, and they would be guests on the show. So I did that for all the time I lived in Boulder. So I taught at the U, and I also produced a child or two, and had this wonderful time during the folk song, the Hootenanny days. And not too many years ago, Judy came to Seattle, and I wanted to go see her, and I tried to go and see her, and they said, oh no, you can't see her. And then in the middle of the show, she said, oh, my friend Maggie Harbaugh Bennett's out there. Harbaugh Bennett. And she taught me a lot of things, some things I wish she hadn't taught me. And so afterward, I went backstage, and we had a big reunion. So that was great to know all those folky people. And those were fun years. And then ended up in Seattle.
And what brought you here?
Well, he got a job with Boeing. Now, he was not hired as a test pilot, but he was in the National Guard, continued flying, and every week he'd go in and tell them, you should hire me as a pilot, and eventually they did. So he spent his career here as a test pilot. And I don't know how it happened, but again, KCTS, public television show again, and I did that for a number of years. Also, a radio show on King FM called The Rummy Dummy Line with that Rummy Dummy song, and it was the sound of an old train that was taking kids on adventures, and you heard the train, and then you climbed aboard, and whatever the theme of the day was.
So those were all kid shows, youth shows, is that right?
The folk song heritage was not kids. Mm-hmm. The Rummy Dummy Line was for children. The other was, you know, general.
Uh-huh.
And we always got good response, and I got loads of fan letters through the years, people that enjoyed the folk music. So we spent all those years, and it was a great time, and I was a subsidized artist. And then there was a period there in the 70s when things got kind of rough, and they had a sign up that said, we're the last person to leave Seattle, turn out the lights. That was, you know, those bad years. And they lent my husband to the airlines or something, and he became enamored of a young 19-year-old stewardess. And to make a long story short, I was rejected for, I was getting too old. I was 40, you know. And so then I decided I needed a real job, and that's when my teaching career kicked in. I still have continued singing and doing things ever since, but not as my primary focus, naturally, when you're teaching school. So then I taught at Mount Si High School. I taught drama. I think I directed some 40 plays in the years I was there, and that's was a, and the kids would, in the speech classes, I'd say, what do you talk about? And I'd say, well, a lot of interesting, it was a logging community, you know, called me. And I said, a lot of interesting folks here. And that's how I met these old loggers. And I had decided at that point to get my PhD anyhow, so I was trying to work on a PhD as well. And I thought, well, I'll collect these lawyer stories. And that would be a good thing. And so I met this one guy who was just so interesting. And he'd been a logger for 35 years, but he never talked about logging. He talked about growing up on the in Idaho, on the Salmon River. And I thought, and I recorded him like 5 different times in the years I was there, because I was at Mount Si for, from 77 to 83. And, those stories were well honed, and, I just realized, he's a fabulous storyteller. So I just focused on him. And then went over to Idaho, because I wanted to get pictures of the locales of all these stories. Just absent, I went over camping one week with my son, and we asked any good storytellers. Well, to make a long story short, I made a whole bunch of other ones. Stories about the same characters. And so that became my dissertation. His stories, as well as the stories of himself, and also his wife and her sisters, because they had also grown up there. So they were all about the turn of the century, being pioneers over there on the Salmon River. And lots of the stories are real funny, the tricks they played on each other. And so that's how I ended up getting a PhD.
Where'd you get it from? The University of
Wisconsin? From Washington. Now, uh-huh. Washington didn't, of course, have folklore. And they kept saying, well, why don't you do T.S. Eliot or something like that? And I said, well, that's not quite what I had in mind. So I was supposedly in oral literature. So I said, this is what I'm proposing to do. And they said, all right. So I sent it off to Indiana, what I was doing. And they said, you let this woman do this. This is golden material. And so they relented.
Because Indiana is such a well-known school to train folklorists.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so they backed me up and said, this is wonderful stuff. You should let her do this. And so consequently, so for my orals, for example, and for my written, I got their reading list that their majors had to take. So I took their exams, and actually for my oral, they sent someone out, bless their heart, from Indiana to be on the orals, And so it's a PhD from University of Washington. They don't really have folklore, but I'm the only folklore graduate.
Well, that's impressive.
Yeah.
And you were talking about doing, and maybe I'm jumping ahead of the story, so cut me off if I am, but when we were chatting before, you were talking about going into schools as a folk singer.
Well,
and that's interesting.
Well, not as a folk singer. After I left, got my degree and everything, let's see, what did I do next? Oh, golly, Mount Si. Well, I know, yeah. I was... I had been teaching drama, and I had 3 children by then and quite a family, to take care of. And drama you have all day and then rehearsal in the evening. And so I said, I think I'll do something different. So I took the real estate course and passed the exam, and I sold one house, and Bremerton Schools called me and said, you've been recommended to teach our gifted elementary children. And I said, well, you must have a mistake. I said, I've taught college, I taught high school, but I've never taught little kids. I performed for them for years, but... Well, I said, well, just come and look. So I went over, and my goodness, here were these little kids, 5, 6, 7 years old, could read like adults. Incredible. So I said, this is just the most incredible thing. So from 1983 to 92... I commuted to Bremerton and taught those little kids, and we could just do anything we wanted, I developed a program where you use all the senses, for example, I'd give them some parts of a word, like X, E-X, and I said, bring me some words with E-X tomorrow. They'd bring you pages of E-X words. Then each one would get to choose one, and we'd write it on the board, and they'd tell me what it meant. And then I say, okay, pick a word, see it in your mind, write it in the air with your hand, turn to your neighbor, spell it for them, and it was just incredible. Total Physical Response Method, it's called. I don't know where I read about it someplace. Anyhow, so that was a wonderful experience, and I could just do anything I wanted with those kids. I had a lot of supportive parents, and we went to all the plays. We visited, you know, the fish hatcheries. We just had a most incredible time. And the librarian complained to the principal that these kids never got anything in the library. I said, the books are too easy for them. They can read them, you know. Sorry, I took them to the public library to get books. And so I did that for you, and it was so much fun. The principal had been at a school in England, and very unusual, we had a mascot, a goat, and we made paths in the woods. The goat would eat the weeds. We raised chickens. Can you imagine a school? And with the garbage from lunch, we fed the chickens. He had a wood shop where the kids could come in and work in wood at noon hour. I had a guy came and we built dulcimers, and then I told him we played dulcimers at noon. It was just incredible. Well, all the other schools were saying, well, how come they get to do all these fun things and we don't? So eventually he retired. They encouraged him to retire early, and they brought somebody in to bring it back in line with standard procedures, and I said, time for me to retire. So that's when I retired.
Well, now, weren't you, was it before that or after that that you were doing artist residencies throughout?
After that.
That was after.
Okay.
Oh, my
after
gosh.
After that, when I left Armandjar School a few years afterward, I started doing folklore for the Arts Commission in Washington and Idaho, folklore in the schools. And it was a wonderful experience. I would go to a community early on and figure out the ethnic and the background of the lore of that particular community. And then bring in, later in the year, a folk artist to work with the children. Sometimes they were sometimes high school, sometimes young, and learn a skill or something from that ethnic background. So for example, with Scandinavian communities, they did rose mauling. And the first day, I would go in and just tell them about folklore and traditions. Then the artists would come, and the artists were paid by the Arts Commission, and they would do rose mauling, you know. And then at the end, we would have a big fair where each child would bring and make an exhibit of things that showed their family background, their heritages. Big, dinner with all kinds of wonderful treats. And we did Croatia, and the Croatians, they did dancing. We did Japanese knot tying. We did Native American over in Port Angeles. And that one was very successful. And the kids made, I think we did some basket weaving and things like that. And we had a big potlatch at the end. And we gave everyone who came to the potlatch got a gift that the children had made. And I don't know if it's still going on, but for years I know that was the beginning of a liaison between the tribe and the school. And then I got to do it in Idaho as well. And that was just so much fun, and did that for years. And then the WASL test came in, which emphasizes testable skills, mathematics and science, etc. And the arts got the short shrift, and they stopped funding those programs. And so that was the end of those, unfortunately. And the arts have actually struggled ever since to be funded in schools, because it doesn't show on the test results, which the schools rise and fail on their test results, on the standardized testing. So then just since then, I've just been, you know, like I said, volunteering. I went to Thailand as a volunteer in Vietnam, and just anybody that'll have me.
But you were telling me also that you're doing, here and there, you're still doing programs in this part of Seattle.
Well, all over, actually. Uh-huh. I got to do, I went with my husband, for example, I did some programs in New Zealand, of all places, but he went to New Zealand for the folk people there. And boy, they knew their folklore. I was doing some British ballads, and I changed some words because it was a little gory. And they came and said, "You changed the words." I said, "Oh my God, these people know. I have to be careful, you know." And all over, any place that would have me, I did for years and years been doing, you know, singing for all over the state and even other places when it works out. I did some, my mother lived in California, I went did some down in Santa Barbara area where she lived, and etc. So anybody that'll have me, but now that I'm getting to be older and I don't have a car anymore, it's not so easy. I have to finagle my way to get to these places to do my programs. But I'm going to be at Folk Life, and I've been there for, I think it's 46 years now.
My goodness, that's a Seattle Folk Festival.
Seattle Folk Festival, and I've been there since it began. And, of course, I was at the original World's Fair, and then we had the 50-year celebration recently, and I got to do that and move back. And so I have not totally forgotten, but it takes a little more effort to get places and finagle a way to get there to do it.
So at the Folk Festival coming up, this will be what, your 47th year?
I think something like that. I can't remember. But it's since they started. And I don't even have to apply or say anything anymore. I'm just automatically on. And I am hoarse, so I'm going to think, okay, I'm going to have to fake it a little bit and tell some stories along the way.
And sing things that are intended to be sung with a husky, gravelly voice.
Right. Yes.
So what might you sing, for example?
Well, the ones I just sang for you.
The Rummy Dummy line?
Yeah, and that sort of thing. And I haven't quite decided, but I think I just might kind of do my life story, and then that way I could do a couple of French songs, you know, and some of the things that I've learned along the way as I've visited different cultures and parts of the world.
What an extraordinary career.
Well, it has been fun, and I love, and I really can't complain because, I mean, how blessed can you be, you know, because I really never had an agent or, you know, it's just everything has just kind of fallen in your lap.
So just to close by circling back to the University of Wisconsin, it sounds like, as I've been listening to you, it seems like you've had several themes, but one of them is using those early days of television to be comfortable in public performance
I mean,
improv.
How could you get a better schooling? One, to do those 4 months of 12 a week.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty hard to scare me. I'm sorry. But I don't get, you know, I should. I'm just a ham. Once a ham, always a ham.
I guess so. And the other theme I've heard is just, you know, because I know you were talking about the Lady Elgin or the lumberjack stories, and that really is all about letting a community know its own culture.
Yes, of
and
course.
And it sounded like you were doing that all the way through
your
residencies.
Just I have. And, and seeking out what's local.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Washington, of course, has wonderful, you know, folklore. This state, we've got the wonderful heritages of all kinds of ethnic groups, wonderful ethnic groups that have maintained their traditions. And in fact, I used to, for years, help out at the Nordic Heritage Museum and ran their summer camp for kids, you know, in the summer. And it was fun. I not just Nordic, but, you know, just any place I can. So I did that for years. That was fun.
So just appreciating the cultures all
around us. The cultures, and there are still. And in fact, I still, because it's just up the hill, go to this, not that I'm Norwegian, I'm not, but I was married to a Norwegian, my second husband, and I used to run their summer camp too. And it's just so much fun to do this stuff with kids, you know.
So just the pleasure of uncovering cultures and giving it back to people.
And I don't know. I've always felt very confident doing it. That's something people will enjoy because they do. You know.
Well, I also wanted to ask you, and this is a question out of the blue. So if it's if it's just way too out of the blue, just withdraw it. But I did look at your master's thesis, and on page one, you've quoted a philosopher named Baker Brownell, and the quote had to do with these days, and this would have been written in 1955, as I remember the book, or the early 50s.
Yeah, I just saw that quote. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And the quote has to do with these days, people...
It's canned.
It's canned culture. In fact,
it
I see that
canned
you're...
canned culture, and so sad.
I see that you're going over to get your thesis, and I would love it.
I'm going to find that quote for you.
It's on page one, as I believe it. And I would love it if you would just read it.
Yes, because I couldn't be more.
There it is.
Here it is. Is this the Baker Bonnell, The Human Community? New York, Harper's, 1950. Brownell says, "Ours is a culture of displaced persons. It is tattered with escape and wandering, and as such is a culture founded on being lost. What the Germans did to millions in concentration camps and the Russians in mass deportations, the Western world in general does less dramatically, but as effectively to hundreds of millions, homelessly swarming to centers of vicarious and secondary culture." It was just that. What was once artistically and religiously an integral behavior of the community or the family, in which all had their active part, has become, over great ranges of our culture, corrupted specialism. We watch thousands hiring others to do their music for them, their poetry, their sports, their painting, their praying, their dancing, in the great leisure time commodities. So he expressed the view that modern man must return to creative activities to regain meaning and significance in life, stability, and a sense of belonging to the community. And I totally agree. I think it's, well, like I say, everybody's walking around with that little gadget in their hand, and it's just hard to have interface, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, what I love about that quote is just, there it was at the start of your professional career, and it sounds like every day that you've lived since then, you've been trying to apply that very idea the communities you've lived and visited.
That's right.
Well, all in all, it says sounds like an amazing life. You're right. You were showing me something that said when you were born, the midwife said that you were going to have a charmed life. It sounds like you've done that.
Well, I really do. I feel that, you know, because, well, one, just all these wonderful opportunities, which I didn't really seek, you know, they just sort of, there they are, you know, you just, will you do it? Well, yeah. And so I just feel very blessed. And, of course, I have this marvelous family support, which not everybody has, unfortunately, has that such wonderful supportive family background. So, and I think the other thing was, it's been hard for me to learn fear. I shouldn't tell you this, but I did get, when I went on that tour with my mother to North Africa, I met her there. I flew from Innsbruck and met her in Morocco. And I thought, well, as long as I'm here, I'd like to see something more before she gets here. So I went to Marrakesh, which was Winston Churchill's favorite place. And they said, now don't go out alone, hire guides. I did just what they said. But when I took the airport cab to the airport, I got driven out, robbed, and left in the desert. That's the first time I knew fear. And up until that point, I thought everybody in the world was good. He didn't kill me. All he did was rob me. But after that, I said, maybe I should be a little more careful. But I really haven't learned that lesson very well.
Well, and thank goodness you haven't, because you've probably been passing on fearlessness to all the students and people you've affected.
Well, you know, I'm getting slowed down, as you can see, but we don't want that on there, but being hit by a car and a pedestrian is making me think twice about trusting drivers to watch out for you. Better catch their eye and, hello, I'm here.
I'll sing you a song if you don't hit me.
So it's an interesting time of life now to see what, you know, I can make of. I still want to keep on with these things as much as I can.
And I'm sure you'll do it.
As much as I can.
So thank you, Maggie Bennett.
My pleasure.
And this will be part of the collection of the UW-Madison Oral History Program. We'll have it online. And if there are other things that you wish you had remembered to say, just send me a note and I'll make sure that it gets put into the record. So,
but primarily we were focusing on the Wisconsin years. I just think they were extremely rich, and my mother, I told you, I remember her saying, I just love Wisconsin. I'd love to live and die in Madison. So she said.
That's wonderful.
And she had, by the way, a gift shop there. And she imported things from Europe. And I met a lady one place and said, "Where'd you get that?" She said, "I bought it at a gift shop in Madison, Wisconsin."
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, Maggie, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you
for singing, and thank you for sharing your story with us and giving me some really wonderful documents.
Well,
and I'll try to find a way of making sure that they stay preserved and stay part of the university's record.
And a way that I can access it then, right?
You bet.
Let's see if there's any I want to see.